Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth there, and it shows that...
Hello, everybody out there in Milwaukee, Mob Land. I hope you guys are all behind something heavy, because we hear we might be hit. Yes, because... We have, as you well know, the one, the only, the god of all things horror. We have the famous, the good-looking S.A. Bradley, the host of Hellbent for Horror. I call him the Chopper because I know his deep crime background. You might know him better as Casey Kasem of radio of all time. But he's on today.
Oh, God.
Oh, God. We know he's great. He's going to illustrate all things holy with us by our discussion of our topic today. With no further ado, good morning, sir. How you doing?
Fantastic. Thanks so much for the kind introduction. I'm really happy to be on this show. I also love how you start the show with Mac the Knife. So you start with a murder ballad, and that's just perfect.
It is. And the thing is, absolutely. I mean, I love not only the play, the space the music comes from, the guy that wrote the play, his life story, the whole thing with that is so wonderful. But first of all, let's get to the topic of the. Let's find out where we can find you on social media before I forget to ask that question.
Sure, great. So I do have a podcast about semi-weekly. I put on a new show, Hellbent for Horror. It's called. It's a podcast about everything related to horror. Basically, I have a very wide door that swings and welcomes a lot of topics into horror. I talk about horror as art and social commentary. So I talk about movies, books, stories that shape me, and things that shape horror as a film style and an art form, and usually played for fun, but also try to come up with a connective tissue between a couple different stories or movies or something that's happened in real life. You can find Hellbent for Horror. The podcast is available on iTunes and Google Play, Player FM, Stitcher. I'm on Hellbent for Horror page on Facebook. On Twitter, it's Hellbent Horror. Couldn't even get the four in there. It was already taken, believe it or not. So Hellbent Horror. And hellbentforhorror.com if you're just going on the big old-fashioned World Wide Web.
Outstanding, and thank you so much for that information. I have listened to your podcast ever since I ran into you, of all places, on Wrong Wheel, where you and James Hancock did a really good, outstanding episode on one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, Sam Peckinpah.
Yeah, thank you. That was great.
You're welcome. But so today we'll be talking about the movie called The Town of Dreaded Sundown, based on the murders took place in Tarkinson, Arkansas, right after the Second World War. We both see the movie. I think we both enjoy it. I think it does a good job telling a story of a group of murders that took place in this town, right, and the people getting upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it did a good job with telling a story but not making fun of the tragedy that happened in that community at the time of the killings. Do you feel the same way?
Well, it's an interesting point that you put up. I think it is one of those movies that transcends what it was originally and has become part of the lexicon for a couple different reasons. I mean, some of the things that you said that it does a pretty good job with the story. I think one of the reasons that this movie is so good and why it is so remembered is that it has actually the way that it decides to show its facts and what it ends up showing on in the movie as true actions actually supersede the truth. In other words, the story itself is really small, and the story is unresolved. But what Charles B. Pierce, who was an Arkansas resident, I think he grew up right in that area, he mythologized the story of his youth and created a Texarkana that is a little bit different than what Texarkana was at that time. And he actually made these murders something that would not be forgotten. He turned what was true into myth. And that's probably one of the more amazing things that a film can do. I mean, as you probably well know, there's a lot of artistic license that's taken. There's a lot of really eerie and grotesque stuff that's done in the movie that didn't happen in real life. And to this day, there are college kids that are in Texas A&M and stuff like that, that will believe that those things that were in the movie are what actually happened. They don't necessarily know the actual crime. But what this does is you don't forget that. This is the Texarkana Moonlight murders could have very easily have been forgotten in the annals of history. But this one movie really changed that.
Absolutely. And when anybody reads about, say, murders online or in newspaper articles at the time, know quickly that they really tried very hard with state-of-the-art at that time technology. And a man of myth himself, Texas Ranger Gonzalez, Lone Wolf Gonzalez, they really tried to solve the case the best way they knew how, and something perhaps they would have been able to do today. But the part of the myth that I enjoy is the fact that the killings happen and da-da-da-da. Not that I enjoy, I mean, it's part of the movie, right? But
understood.
In no way, shape, or form do they make fun of the murder victims. They don't do a lot of unnecessary graphic, say, slasher film type stuff that we see in movies like Hassle 2. It's not torture porn, in my opinion, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's actually interesting that you would say that, because it's really a matter of timing. Believe it or not, when that movie came out, it was an American International picture, and AIP was known for the drive-in circuit, and Charles Pierce made this movie after he made a movie called Legend of Boggy Creek, which I also really love. It's a good semi-true story Bigfoot movie, this movie actually got hit for its violence, and he had to kind of take like the Sam Peckinpah stance for a little bit there, saying, well, I did that as an unflinching thing so that people would recognize that people actually died. I didn't want to gloss over that. So, you know, Don Wells playing one of the characters that gets shot in the face, you know, the blood hits the back of the wall. And at that time, that was considered pretty graphic, especially for a movie that was not, say, A-listers. You know, sometimes they make a little bit of they kind of nod and say, okay, you can get away with that for artistic integrity, but when you're dealing with AIP, you know, they're ready to slash that stuff right away. So it's interesting that at that time, Town That Dreaded Sundown was actually kind of rugged, and I think that's one of the reasons it also kind of survives and plays well today, is that there's a ruthlessness to the Phantom when he's trying to pull guys through the doors. And he's angry, but he doesn't say stupid things. He looks very minimalist in his own way. He is kind of like a slasher character in how he's perceived. It's really interesting to me that in a way that violence, which now is very, very tame, was at one point considered nasty. Now, was it really nasty? Hey, when you're dealing with true stories and people are still alive while the movie's out that were friends and family of the people who died, every little thing is going to get scrutinized because sensitivities, things like that. But yeah, I do think you're correct in that he really doesn't make fools out of the victims. I won't say that he doesn't do that with his own cameo as one of the police officers. He plays Sparkplug, and that's kind of weird. But at the same point, I think he does do a dramatic mood that is really, really smart for that kind of movie and made it much more different than a lot of the movies that were out that were kind of like that. I remember being really impressed and scared first time I saw Town the Dreaded Sundown as a kid, because I was used to how those AIP movies tended to be. You know, you hear the narration and it's going to be really, really bad acting and it's not going to be scary. They're going to cut away. And this movie didn't. It really kind of went straight ahead.
Did, and that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about that movie, is I think it plays well now compared to a lot of things that we suffer with. I think Town That Dreaded Sundown plays well. I think it plays far better, in my opinion, than say any number of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre films do.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I'll
say that. Go
ahead. No, I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, not a problem. I was going to say that one of the things that I'll probably keep coming back to is that the movie itself is kind of like the its own urban legend, and mm-hmm. that kind of helps it really keep fresh. Like, they did a remake of it, and I usually hate remakes, but I'll recommend the Town That Dreaded Sundown remake because it was made by people who obviously loved Town That Dreaded Sundown. Most of the remakes that you see, they don't like the source material. They're trying to take the name and turn it into something new. But this movie knew the difference between the movie and the facts, and created a whole movie around that urban legend idea that was in there. And I thought that that was actually pretty clever. And what they did in that way was they actually brought in some of the stuff that, if you do some sleuthing around the murders that actually happened, the Moonlight murders, they put in clues about the guys who were actually prime suspects. They bring up areas that are built up and everything. So they bring in the end of the movie, the sand pit and stuff like that. And so that's a movie done by fans. You know, that's somebody right. who saw that this was actually an urban legend and built it up. I almost like consider Town That Dreaded Sundown the first movie creepypasta that was out there, the first Slenderman kind of thing, because it grew out of a story, right? And
sure.
it really became something much, much bigger. And, I mean, the whole idea of how he shoots that movie is very interesting. And I don't know, Charles B. Pierce, how talented he really was. I watched an interview with Andrew Prine, who stars as the deputy who plays next to Ben Johnson a lot. And he was saying, you know, I wrote the last fifth of that movie because we didn't have an end. It was basically, these people get shot and then, you know, he disappears. So I came up with the whole sand pit thing and the train and him getting shot, him hiding in the bog. So none of that actually happened in the real world. No. But in urban legend world, it has. And that actually supersedes the real world. People don't talk about that when you talk about this thing. They talk about, well, I think he died in the swamp somewhere. Yeah, and he may have, who knows? But he also may have been one of the 400 people that got arrested during the investigation.
And one person went to jail for life, I believe, for running car theft ring. And yeah, we'll never know.
Right.
Which also makes it possible for the urban myth to go on. It's fascinating that you brought up Slender Man, because Slender Man, even though I haven't heard much about him lately, still is very much alive, still very much active in the minds of teenagers, because we had two people near here where I live outside of Racine, Wisconsin, take their friend, mutual friend, out to a wooded area and try to sacrifice her to Slender Man.
Right, right. I mean, I've got to say, there's a reason I will not mess with you, sir, because you come from Wisconsin, and there are quite a few really dangerous people that have come from there. So I'm glad that you had me, put a bandage and what do you call it, over my eyes, so that I can't figure out where you are, even though we're just on the phone. That's really taking a good chance. But yeah, Slender Man is actually, they're doing an HBO documentary on that, and that's going to be coming out within the new year. So it's not dead. Those things, especially unsolved stuff, and, you know, Town That Dreaded Sundown isn't alone in this. I mean, I'm out here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We had Zodiac, and Zodiac
yes,
being unsolved. And there's several things about those two cases that are very similar. That whole thing of somebody out in the mist, somebody that gets away, we don't catch them. It's just a magnet for urban legend. It's magnet for stories and legends and lore coming out of grandpa and grandma. I watched a documentary from I'm not sure what college it was. I want to say it was Texas A&M about this movie and about the murders themselves and the differences between what Charles Pierce showed me and what I thought Texarkana was and what Texarkana was at that time, really. I mean, it was 40,000 people, but it was a crossroads for soldiers that were passing through. So they had this Red River Arsenal, which is a place that they made all the armaments. They had four railroad companies in town. So it was a huge transient thing. Railroads and trains were coming in. So people were coming in and out of that town left and right. There were five major highways that built up their downtown, and there were outskirts of that were tourist camps, little motels, motor lodges that had diners and bars nearby. So it had a big city kind of thing going on in it, but it also had this small town world that was inside of it. So same geography, small town inside of it, small town feel, and also this weird big city kind of feel that has basically vicious beatings and stuff. So like the first so that's a whole different Texarkana than what I see in that movie. What I see in that movie is, you know, a town with four or five main streets. There's four cops, four patrol calls for 40,000 people. So there's one car per 10,000 persons, you know, stuff like that is in there. But he creates the legend of those outskirts areas. But what that does say is that there was a lot of violence in that town. And if you look at it, there's an author named James Presley, and he wrote, quote unquote, the definitive book on the murders. His father was one of the sheriffs. And so he wrote that, you know, the first assault, Jimmy Hollis and Mary Larry, they're the only ones who saw the killer at all or even described the killer. Everybody else does not. They're either dead because they all got shot, or they didn't see the person. They just saw like their dead husband, which is the last murders. But the first assault, they didn't even think that that was anything related to some kind of serial killer, because the two were actually married but to other people. And the way that the brutal beatings were gave them the idea that it was a crime of passion, especially because the woman was assaulted with a pistol, the barrel of a pistol. Right. And so they were like, this is very similar to what happens a lot. So James Presley talked about how there were a lot of murders prior to that assault that were in similar places with similar backgrounds, because there was a lot of that going on. He said during the World War, this was a very, very rough town. He goes, in fact, the last lynching was in 1941. So that was only 5 years earlier. There was definitely, this was not a place where it was the sad, scared little citizens in the village. These people were willing to take a gun and go out there. In fact, when the Phantom was active, there were teenagers, gangs of teenagers that would sit in lovers' lanes with rifles waiting for someone to come and try and get them, and they were going to bag the Phantom themselves. So a little bit different of a feel than what we get out of the movie, but it's fascinating to see you know, that kind of thing. I'm sorry, I'll talk forever.
No, you're racking this out a lot. I really appreciate it. To me, it always comes back out down to the lover lane idea. It's a story of caution. Mm-hmm. Don't go out at night with the woman and do these things, because the bad guy will get you. You know, be it the guy with a pistol or the guy with a hook. You know, it's a cautionary tale.
Yes. And I think that's another reason why this movie lasts as long as it does in the minds of people. And I think it's a very good, very well-paced movie. It is a weird movie, too, because if you look at the difference between fact and fiction, they really put in some really strange stuff. And it's kind of bizarre in how, you know, the movie's made in 76, 77. So it is already kind of taking some of its ideas from reality, but also some of the myth and urban legend that has been going since 1947, when you're not hearing about the Phantom doing anything anymore. So he's learning some urban legend himself, like the idea that he was a sex killer. The idea that there was a sex maniac going around killing people didn't happen until the farmhouse where Virgil, the husband, was shot in front of the window and the wife gets away. And the reason that that came up was because the police on the scene saw there was a huge amount of money in the house, and the guy didn't go after the money. And he attacked the wife, and they said, well, I don't know. And at that time, there's not profilers like you have in Silence of the Lambs. They're going off of the things that they know. And they're like, I don't know. This guy seems like maybe he's a sexual predator if he's not going for money. He's not going for money. The number two is sex. And what ended up happening was a news reporter heard that, and overnight, sex fiend. Da, 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 da. So that becomes part of the thing that goes by word of mouth. And yet, if you look at the movie, The movie embellishes on this. Like they say that, well, he chewed on her breast. I mean, literally chewed on her breast. That never happened. There was no chewing on any people.
No.
That was never done. But they show it in the movie. That's a really weird, uneasy thing that we hear that makes us feel that there's something really, really wrong with this guy, that he might even be like a monster of his own type because he's doing something really, really perverse. And the whole trombone thing, obviously, you know, that's one of the most amazing horror sequences. Like, you can't believe ever that you're watching it and that that's actually being done. And it obviously didn't happen. That has now, though, become part of the urban legend. People do believe that that happened. And I think it's interesting that he looked at what actually happened. The girl had an alto sax. The alto sax was gone from the scene of the crime. The police decided to try and look in pawn shops and see if they could find the guy. They couldn't. And then that's it. The story ends. Good storyteller goes, no, the story can't end there. If you're going to have a trombone or a saxophone in play, something has to happen with it. And him changing it to a trombone and having this weird phallic crazy penetration thing, I mean, he was on to something. He kind of presages some of the slasher stuff. And what does that do? It makes us remember this story that would have been lost in the annals of history. I mean, it got on Life magazine in the 40s, but being that the story wasn't as sensational as so many other things that happened just a little bit after that, it could have been forgotten, but it's not at this point because of this movie.
Absolutely. In some strange way, not only the killer, but the victims are remembered. You know, they'll never
right.
know. We'll never know who did the killing, but at least we'll know that in a period of town, this town was victimized by this horrible person or persons, and these people and their names will be remembered. And thankfully, that's
so
none that will be. What? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was about to say there were so many suspects as well. I mean, this was taken very seriously by the people who were there. And in a weird way, it almost feels like a hysteria. People accusing their neighbors, people accusing family members that they were having arguments with. There was a German prisoner of war that was in town. And there was a guy who was hypnotized and said that he was hypnotized and did something. There was this really, really strange thing of how many people were getting accosted about this. And you don't know. Maybe they did actually get that guy. But as you mentioned, the family members are remembered. The victims are remembered. And there is a little bit of this was an American International Pictures movie. It was a drive-in film. It was exploitation. It did play hard and fast with the rules and with the facts to a point where the Texas legislature sued AIP to try and get this is a true story, only the names have been changed out of there because there were so many discrepancies. One of the family members actually sued because of how he felt the sister that had died was represented in the movie. Like, he thought that it made her look like she had loose morals because she ended up at a lover's lane. And so it's all perception, but at the same point, it's also, you know, there's something to be said about the weirdness of infamy and the weirdness of urban legend. It's much, much bigger than the murders, and it's much, much bigger than the victims. It becomes this, as you mentioned, cautionary tale. It takes over and has its own life. And in a weird way, Charles Pierce had lightning in a bottle by creating this movie.
Yeah. And the other movies he was part of, too. He has quite the film career. He did another one or two weird crime movies as well that I'll have to take a look at. But I think and he also was part of one of my favorite films of all time, Outlaw Joan Jewels.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, he's a good guy. And what's nice, what I like about the film, again, it's a nice cautionary tale. It's something, 2016, right? There's all kinds of horror movies out there. I think it plays well against a lot of them we have today because it speaks to base human thought.
Yeah, and I think it also speaks to how we like to look at ourselves. I mean, there is a a humanity in that film. The sirs and pleased to meet you, sir, and all of that. There's a very salt of the earth kind of straightforwardness to the people who are doing it. Some guys might be goofy, but you know that they're at least trying. And there's something that is very, very solid about that kind of thing. And, you know, horror, I think, is the cautionary tale and the allegory for true crime. True crime is like the police report on the dark side of humanity. And so the thing that you see in a police report is all fact. And that can sometimes feel very, not sterile, but it can be grim. I mean, sometimes there's no hope when you're looking at true crime. It is a dark, dark story. Horror brings allegory to that. And it kind of brings a little bit more cautionary to. And you can stretch the truth a little bit like pizza dough and get it to where it feels a lot more palatable. And I think that this movie is one of those that does that rather well. I mean, the reality is the lone wolf was kind of a butthead. He was a guy who wanted he wanted the cameras on. He told everybody, you talk through me. He was a glory hound.
The
sheriff said the only danger about getting around this guy is getting between him and a camera. But they don't do that in the movie. What they do is they give you Ben Johnson, one of the greatest cowboys ever in history, period. One guy that you could believe no matter what. If he was selling you a car, you'd believe Ben Johnson. He comes out being Lone Wolf, and the first thing he does is says, all stuff comes through me, and I don't want to talk to any press until I have to. He completely cuts that down. He has that disdain. And that's something that we kind of feel safe with the guy. You know, he's not going to let, you know, other people tell the story. He's just going to try and find this guy. And there is that feel all the way through the movie. People, if they can, they do the right thing. When the farmhouse raid happens and the husband is shot in the head with a 22, and although in the movie it's not a 22 rifle, it's a silencer 32, he's shot, and then the wife gets shot in the face, and we get this real horror movie sequence of her crawling out of the house. When she gets to a house, an elderly guy with a shotgun comes out, and he's just searching the place. He's ready. He's armed for bear. He's going to take care of his neighbor. And I think we respond to that in a way, even if it's not what was actually happening in Texarkana at the time. It's how we feel about ourselves. And allegory is very important. That's how we learn our rules. That's how we learn what we think of ourselves. That's how we get our morals of the story, is that sometimes things are heightened.
Absolutely. And what I like, going back to the small town aspect that you talked about earlier, if we look at Texarkana as a small town and elements that it did have of that, I would want my small town neighbors to come to my aid. I live in a city outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We have horrific crime here. In fact, about a month ago, we had two people try to break in my home. Because we have so many recently immigrated Hispanics up this way, for the first time ever, if they heard my wife scream, they'd come to her aid and they'd bring guns. Where before our old neighbors would simply hide and say, well, it's not happening to me, I don't care.
I feel you. I live outside of Oakland and Oakland, California. And what I can tell you is that even the old ladies are tough in Oakland. You wouldn't want to mess with the old ladies here. My neighbors know my neighbors. They know me, and I try to do something every year to bring people to the house. It's usually Halloween. I have a real nice setup and everything, but we get to be neighbors. And I remember when I was growing up, it was a whole different world in the way that neighbors responded to each other than it is now. You really do have to kind of make your neighborhood your town. You need to know everybody who's there.
Make it your Mayberry, so when the killer comes by at night, you're looking out for each other. The little English lady told me it was time to shut the show down. I apologize for this. We'll escort you back out of the car so you can deliver it back to the safe house safely, and we'll let your family members go. Again, can you give us where we can find you online so people who would want to send you coded messages can do so?
Sure, of course. I'm at Hellbent for Horror. You can subscribe to the Hellbent for Horror podcast on iTunes or Google Play, Player FM or Stitcher. You can keep up with Hellbent for Horror on Facebook as well. I have a Hellbent for Horror page. There's also a Twitter page, Hellbent Horror. I will say that at Hellbent Horror is a great place to find me. A lot of people have some great conversations with me. And if you really want to just go down the old World Wide Web world, hellbentforhorror.com is also available to you.
Outstanding. Again, I thank you so much, sir, for being on the show with me today and talking about what I think will go down forever as a great classic horror film.
I thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for giving me some of your time, and thanks for putting on this show. It's fun to hear true crime.
All right. Thank you, sir. With that, goodbye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. The little lady is about to cut me off. Have a great day, all, and Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.